Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. I have to ask you to please excuse my voice. I have a sore throat, and so it sounds like I have a collection of frogs in my voice today. And since I have a collection of frogs in my voice, it's quite appropriate that I'm discussing the sutta on the simile of the serpent, because serpents are very fond of frogs. They like to eat them. Okay, so far we have discussed the sutta through verse number 5. And now we come to verse number 6. I will read the English translation. I don't quite agree with it. He who bears no grudges in his heart, transcending all this thus and otherwise, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. I'll read the Pali also, then I'll translate directly from the Pali the way I understand it. Yes, antarato nasanti kopa iti bhava bhavatan ca viti vato so bhikkhu jahati oraparang urago jinamiva tachang puranang. The first line, literally translated, would read, for whom from within there are no maybe eruptions, explosions, commotions, who has transcended being this and that, or who has transcended this state of being and that state of being. Then the rest is the same. Such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. So in the first line, the key word is kopa, which Venerable Jnanapanika has translated as grudges, but a grudge suggests a persisting state of resentment, enmity, dislike. And I don't see that as being the actual meaning of kopa. Kopa is a state of annoyance or irritation which breaks out in the form of an eruption of anger, outbursts, or even simply disturbance of mind. And so the defilement here, the key defilement, is anger. And kopa is more or less a synonym for koda, which is translated as wrath in the first verse. So I don't think this needs further elaboration. And then the second line, translated, transcending all this thus and otherwise, but I see it as having transcended existence in one state or another. This means one who has given up the craving to go on existing in one state or in some other state, to go on existing in the different states of being within samsara. And I couldn't find a parallel to this verse in the two other versions of this Uruga Sutta that are available to me. One is the Gandhari version, and the other is the version from the Gandhari version is in the Gandhari Dharmapada, and the other is the version preserved in Sanskrit in the Udana Varga. Okay, I'll go on now to verse number 7. He who has burned out his evil thoughts, entirely cut them off within his heart, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as the serpent sheds its worn-out skin. The Pali says, yasa vitaka vidupita ajitang suvikapita asesa so bhikkhu jahati oraparang urago jinamiva tachang puranang. The Pali doesn't make an explicit reference to evil thoughts. It says simply, one for whom thoughts have been burnt out. But since even arhants, even the Buddha, still have thoughts, clearly the reference is to unwholesome thoughts. And the commentary fills in the reference by first explaining the three main types of unwholesome thoughts. That is, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty. Then it mentions various other types of minor unwholesome thoughts, thoughts of attachment to relatives, thoughts of attachment to one's home, thoughts about one's reputation. All those minor thoughts, any kind of thought that is infected by the three root defilements of greed, aversion, or delusion, all of those, this meditator, this monk, has entirely cut them off within his heart. So this indicates the end state of a process of first controlling, then mastering, then subduing one's thoughts, and then eventually cutting off all unwholesome thoughts. And this mastery of thoughts is a process that takes place in stages. And so to master the unwholesome thoughts, first one has to use different techniques or methods. By applying wholesome thoughts that are specifically opposed to the unwholesome thoughts. In this way, one gets some control over the unwholesome thoughts, and one generates within one's mind the good, wholesome tendencies that can counteract those unwholesome thoughts. And so, for example, to overcome, to master unwholesome thoughts of sensuality, the Buddha recommends the contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body, examining the body in terms of its constituent parts, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, then going beneath the skin to the flesh, tendons, bones, bone marrow, then to the internal organs, then to the bodily fluids. And so gaining this perception of the body is composed of these unattractive tissues, fluids, component parts, counteracts thoughts of sensuality. Then to overcome thought of ill will or anger, he recommends cultivating the thought or the mind of metta, of loving kindness, developing towards all beings the wish for their welfare and happiness. To overcome thoughts of cruelty or harmfulness, one develops the thought of compassion, reflecting that all beings are just like oneself. They want to be free from pain, free from suffering. And so one then develops towards them the deep wish that they be free from pain and suffering. And this will counteract thoughts of cruelty or harmfulness. Then once one overcomes the grosser unwholesome thoughts, to overcome the subtle, distracting, deflective thoughts, one chooses any type of meditation object as a kind of post to which one can bind the mind, something that will anchor the mind upon a single object and prevent the mind from slipping away into wandering thoughts. And as one binds the mind to the object, then one learns to focus the mind, to unify that mind upon the object. And so then one is able to suppress and to silence those distracting, disturbing thoughts. But this process of training or taming the mind is only a way of bringing the unwholesome thoughts into a state or condition of quiescence or suppression. It's not enough to actually burn them out. To burn them out or to cut them off entirely, one has to develop insight. And it is by developing insight wisdom, the insight into the three characteristics, that one eventually reaches the world-transcending paths and fruitions. And it is the attainment of these path and fruition stages that cuts off the unwholesome thoughts entirely within the mind. And so when the verse here speaks about burning out evil thoughts, cutting them off entirely within the heart, it's speaking about one who is cut out the evil thoughts by reaching the stages of the path and fruition. Okay, the next verse, verse number 8. Here we now begin a series of verses which all have the first line, and that seems to give a special importance to this first line. I'll read it first in the Pali, verse number 8. Yo natchasari napatchasari sabang achagama imang papanchang So bhikkhu jahati oraparang urago jinamiva tachang puranang. And the translation says, he who neither goes too far nor lags behind, entirely transcending the diffuseness of the world, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. The first line here is an interesting way of indicating the Buddha's, we call it the middle way of practice. And it shows the middle way of practice by showing the two extremes that are to be avoided. And it shows these two extremes not explicitly or in theoretical terms, but it uses metaphorical language to indicate the middle way. One extreme here is called going too far. This is acchasari, going beyond the limits. That's like somebody who is aiming at a particular goal and rushes past that goal and so fails to reach the goal simply because he overshoots the mark. And the opposite of that is pachasari, which is going backwards or lagging behind, not going quickly enough, failing to reach the goal because one doesn't make sufficient effort to attain the goal. And the two extremes here can be exemplified on a variety of levels. You could say in the level of views, philosophical views, on the level of way of life, and also on the way of practice, Dhamma practice, by those who accept and follow the Buddha's teaching. So in terms of theoretical views, one might say that the view of eternalism is a view that lags behind in that it encourages attachment to existence, to this world. While the view of annihilationism is a view that goes too far in that it sees that usually the annihilationist sees the danger in samsaric existence, but he goes too far in that he posits a self that has to be annihilated to gain freedom or liberation from existence. Or one might even say that eternalism, here we reverse its position, it goes too far in that it encourages people to aim for some eternal life beyond this world, while now we reverse them. Annihilationism or nihilism, moral nihilism, lags behind in that sometimes it encourages people to just indulge in sensual pleasures because they don't believe in any life or any existence beyond the present one. Okay, so this is a a way in which this distinction between going too far and lagging behind can be exemplified by way of contrasting or opposite views, then by way of taking it by way of ways of life. The Buddha speaks about the middle way as a way that transcends the two extremes of indulgence in sensual pleasures and self-mortification, self-affliction. So we can say that the person, the ascetic who engages in self-mortification goes too far in that he is one who sees the need for renunciation, for overcoming craving, but he goes too far in that he attempts to eliminate craving in the wrong way by tormenting the body rather than by cultivating the mind. And then at the opposite end, the one who indulges in sensual desire, that person lags behind, because that person doesn't make any effort to overcome desire, to overcome craving. Okay, and then taking these extremes in way of Dhamma practice, by people who do have confidence in the Buddha Dharma, we might take some of the pairs of contrasting mental faculties or spiritual faculties. We can say that somebody who has the faculty of faith but doesn't develop the faculty of wisdom enough is somebody who lags behind, because faith on its own is not sufficient to lead a person towards wisdom, towards liberation. Whereas somebody who has, we call this not really wisdom, but intelligence or an intellectual understanding of the Dharma, but doesn't have faith, often goes too far, because they get their mind wrapped up in, sometimes in very enticing, very elaborate philosophical theories, very clever intellectual constructions, or they use their intelligence, their intellect, to grasp the teaching intellectually and engage in argumentation with others without making any effort to apply it in practice. And so they go too far because they often just land in extreme philosophical positions without using that intelligence, without coupling it with faith and using faith and wisdom together in order to advance towards true insight, true wisdom. And so to gain true wisdom, one has to take the faculties of faith and wisdom and develop them in balance. And then one neither goes too far nor lags behind. Then the other two faculties that have to be balanced are energy and samadhi or concentration. One who has very strong energy but not sufficient concentration, not sufficient quietude of mind often goes too far, because that person pushes himself too hard, makes too strong an effort. But because the mind is not properly balanced, that effort often just becomes a futile expenditure of energy. And so the person often becomes just restless and agitated. Then a person who develops quietude of mind but doesn't have sufficient energy will often sink into a kind of dull samadhi, not a bright, luminous, penetrating samadhi, but a kind of just a dull, complacent, quiet of mind. But that kind of quiet mind is not sharp and efficient as an instrument for developing wisdom. And that is a person who is lagging behind. And so, in order to neither go too far nor to lag behind, one has to bring into balance energy and concentration. And what brings all of these faculties into balance, what balances faith and intelligence, what balances energy and concentration, is the faculty of mindfulness. Okay, so when one neither goes too far nor lags behind, and this ties in this interesting sutta that comes the very beginning of the Samyutta Nikaya, the first sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, a deva comes to the Buddha and says to him, "How is it that you crossed the flood?" And here the flood means the flood of samsara, the flood of the round of existence. And the Buddha says, it is by not striving or not struggling and by not standing still that I crossed the flood. And when the Buddha said this, then the deva was puzzled and said, how is it that by not struggling and by not standing still you crossed the flood? Because for somebody, when they're swept away by a flood, in order to get to safety, usually they have to strive and struggle in the water. Then at certain other points, they have to stop and rest. But here the Buddha, this is a kind of paradox. Without making any effort, without struggling, and without standing still, he crossed the flood. Then the Buddha said, when I struggled, then I got swept away. When I stood still, then I sank. It is in this way that by not struggling and by not standing still, I crossed the flood. And so this idea of not struggling, that connects with the idea of not going too far and the idea of not standing still, that goes with not lagging behind. Okay, so one who neither goes too far nor lags behind entirely transcends the diffuseness of the world. And here the text uses a very important word in Pali. The word is papancha. I'll write that. This is a word with that occurs in a number of suttas in the early canonical texts, and it has a number of nuances. I think it's translated into Chinese as Shilun. Is that Shilun? Which means something like play with words, is that correct? Play with. But at any rate, that seems to be taking only one nuance of the original Pali word. The word is based upon a root meaning to expand, to swell out. And so often the word is used in the sense of, I translate it as conceptual elaboration. Or another, there's a monk in Sri Lanka named Venerable Jnanananda who's translated it as conceptual proliferation. And this, in that sense, papancha means the tendency of the mind to develop conceptual schemes, conceptual interpretations that are superimposed upon reality and that distort our understanding of things. And the most important papanchas are those conceptual schemes that revolve around the idea of I, mine, and myself. But in this verse, I think that papancha means, simply is translated in here, the diffuseness or multiplicity of the world. And here this multiplicity or diffuseness of the world is contrasted with nibbana, which is said to be nipapancha, that which is not diffuse, not elaborated, not diversified, not something which is multiplied. And so one who neither goes too far nor lags behind and entirely transcends the diffuseness of the world, this multiplicity, this diversity of the world, such a monk gives up the here, that is existence in this world, and the beyond, existence in any life beyond the present one, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay, now we come to verse number 9. He who neither goes too far nor lags behind, again, exactly the same as before, and knows about the world, this is all unreal. Such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. And I read the Pali. Yo nachasari napachasari sabang vidatan idanti nyatva loke. So bhikkhu jahati ora parang urago jinamiva tachang puranang. Okay, the first line we've already explained, but now we come to a very important line, is the second line, which it's difficult to translate very precisely. The Pali says sabbang vi tatang idang. Yeah, the key word vitattam, it's based on the stem is tattam, which has the implication of being true, authentic, genuine, real. And vi has a depriving sense, unreal, ungenuine, untrue. And what is this sabbang that is being described as unreal? All in the world, it is everything, according to the commentary, it is everything that is conditioned. All the five aggregates, aggregate of form, feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness, all the 12 sense bases, that is the 6 sense faculties and their objects, the 18 elements and so on. So everything conditioned is said to be vitattam, unreal. But when it's said to be unreal, we have to understand this very carefully. It doesn't mean that everything is absolutely illusion. But rather, what it means, at least this is the way I would understand it, is that everything is different from the way it is normally conceived to be. Everything exists, I would say, rephrase it, everything exists in a different mode from that in which we normally conceive things to exist. The commentary says that things, when things are said to be vitattang, what is meant is that they are devoid of any core of permanent substantial reality. That they are devoid of permanence, devoid of sukha, of any kind of true, lasting pleasurableness or happiness, that they are devoid of anything substantial like a self or an eternal reality. Things do exist, but they exist in a different way from the way in which we normally conceive them. There's a verse that occurs in various places in the Nikayas. It also occurs later in the Sanyutta, in the Sutta Nipata. Yena yena hi manyanti tato tang hoti anyata. In whatever way they conceive it, the thing is always different from that. So normally we conceive things to exist independently, but everything exists in dependence upon other things. Normally we conceive things to exist substantially from their own side, but things exist as parts of a network of relations. Normally we exist things to exist with some kind of enduring identity, but everything is really existing as a process. Everything is constantly undergoing change, moment after moment after moment. And our senses are so constituted as to present things to us as existing with some kind of enduring, independent reality. But when we tune the mind through the cultivation of constant mindfulness to our own bodily and mental experience, then we can see and experience our own bodies, our own minds, as undergoing constant change, moment after moment. And from this we can then experience things external to ourselves, always undergoing this constant moment-by-moment change. And so when one experiences and knows the nature of the world, that everything is dependently existing, everything is conditioned by other things, one knows that everything is devoid of any kind of independent existence, any kind of substantial reality. Everything is devoid of any kind of self-nature. And to know things in this way is to know that everything is vitattam, devoid of genuine or substantial reality. Okay, then verses 10 to 13 can all be taken together as one set. Okay, these verses all work on the same theme. He who neither goes too far nor lags behind, greedless, he knows this is all unreal. The next verse says, lust-free, he knows this is all unreal. Hate-free, he knows this is all unreal. Delusion-free, he knows this is all unreal. Such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay, these verses are all making the same point as verse number 9. But what is distinctive about them is that they are showing that the elimination of the three unwholesome roots becomes the condition for gaining this knowledge of everything is being unreal. There are four verses, and I speak about three unwholesome roots. The two verses 10 and 11, which speak about being devoid of greed, vita lobo, and devoid of lust, vita rago. Greed and lust are really used as synonyms. So those two verses are just saying exactly the same thing. It's just almost a redundancy. But the implication of these verses is that it is greed, hatred, and delusion, these three unwholesome roots, that prevent us from knowing that everything is vitattam, devoid of substantial reality. It is greed, hatred, and delusion that cause the projection of the notion of substantial reality onto the world. So the reason why things appear to us to be substantial, independently existing, solidly existing, to have some kind of permanent existence, to appear to be attractive, alluring, to hold out some promise of lasting happiness, is because of greed, hatred, and delusion. The most fundamental of these three is delusion. delusion is the most fundamental unwholesome root. From delusion there comes greed or lust, and again from delusion there comes hatred or aversion. So we could say that delusion is at the bottom, and from delusion come these two other unwholesome roots: greed, which is the force of attraction, the positive evaluation of things. Greed is what makes things appear pleasant and desirable. We could say that delusion is what makes things appear to be lasting, substantial, permanent, solid, and independently existing. Then greed is what makes those permanent, substantial things appear to be attractive, alluring, desirable. And aversion or hatred is what creates the appearance of things as being threatening, as being undesirable, as being fearful or dangerous. And so usually our minds are turning around between these two alternatives, two doorways of running out towards what is attractive and desirable, and either running away from what is fearful and threatening, or else attacking and seeking to vanquish, to conquer what is fearful and threatening. But when one overcomes delusion or ignorance, one knows this is all unreal. And then greed falls away, no more appearance of things as being attractive, desirable. Hatred falls away, no more appearance of things as being threatening, fearful, undesirable. And then one has this knowledge that everything is vitatang, unreal, devoid of substantial reality, and one then gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay, maybe I will stop here. And then just ask if there are any questions, comments. Yes?
I hope I didn't misunderstand homini. When you say go too fast, go too young, or that depends, what this sutta try to imply is that really nothing to do with the speed, but more something to do with vipassana, right? Am I interpreting it right? Because the speed is not an issue here. It's more like this sutta is trying to use example, like he's talking about go too fast or stand still, mainly trying to imply everything is vitaka. Am I understanding correct? Or he really means the speed. We needed to hold like the speed, like the speed in a highway.
Yeah.
You know, not to exceed 50 miles per hour. Is that what his true meaning, or is he trying to imply something else?
Oh, it's not referring to speed of movement. These are more mental attitudes. Attitudes of what I would call attitudes of understanding, way of life, mode of practice.
Yeah, but this really troubles me because everyone was made of different, maybe people in different cities, okay?
Yeah.
Maybe all my life I have to survive in this city, and the other people, maybe they could only survive or feel comfortable in a certain place.
Mm.
And how couldn't this scooter affect people with different pace? Okay, I'm not going to use different pace. What's wrong with different pace? I mean, the whole thing he tried bothered me because how come we have to, we are not in the highway. As long as I don't block the people, could I be on my own pace? Should I try to speak Chinese? Sorry. No?
No, I understand you. But it's not speaking about the speed at which one does things, but it's speaking about by neither going too far nor lagging behind. I say by, it's referring to views. These are philosophical views. These are modes of understanding. Ways of life and ways of practice. And again, I'll just try to fill these in with the examples that I used in the talk. Okay, by ways of understanding or philosophical views, there are some views which are said to go too far in that they go beyond a correct understanding of reality. This would be the annihilationist view. The view which lags behind is the eternalist view, because that is a view that encourages an attachment to existence, attachment to life in this world. The middle view, yeah. Okay, there's a sutta, the famous sutta, the Kacchanagota Sutta. The Buddha says, the world, for the most part, is attached to one of two extremes. It exists. And it doesn't exist. Existence, the view of existence, the view of non-existence. So we could say the view of existence is lagging behind the view of non-existence going too far. The Buddha says the middle way is the way of dependent origination. Yuan qi. That's in terms of views, in terms of conduct. Again, the example that I gave, the way of self-mortification. This is the practice of extreme asceticism, is a way of, that's a very gross way of going too far. A way of lagging behind is a way of sensual enjoyment. But these are gross examples. What we can see, even very subtle examples, just in maybe one's own behavior. Sometimes one becomes maybe too rigid, say in the observance of, well, one should always observe the precepts carefully and strictly, but sometimes one becomes too tight in one's mind in upholding the precepts, not observing them in a natural way. That one could say is maybe going too far, but not observing them at all, or observing them in a rather casual way, that is lagging behind. So the middle way is to observe them, but to do so with a relaxed and easy mind, not with a tight and rigid mind. And again, in the way of even the way of meditation practice, if one is practicing with a very tight mind, struggling too strenuously, that is going too far. If one is not making any effort at all, or just letting the mind sink and drift, that is lagging behind. In another sutta, the Buddha uses the famous example about tuning up a lute in order to get music from the lute. If you make the strings too tight, then the strings will break. If you let the strings be too loose, then when you pluck the strings, then you just get a droning sound. You don't get any kind of music. And so for the lute, to play the lute properly, the strings have to be tuned to the right pitch. Not too tight, not too loose. So that seems to be the implication of this verse. Is that clear?
Thank you. So it seems like the person would be out of step with the Noble Eightfold Path and not have right effort and not have right view.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, so one who is going too far or lagging behind is one who doesn't have right view, who is taking an extreme view. And even somebody who has right view can still not be applying effort correctly, either making too strenuous or too tight an effort, or not exerting it, not making an effort at all, not making the proper effort. It's a very suggestive line, which has, you could say, it has meanings on many levels. One can't really just pin it down to one literal meaning and say this is the exact meaning and no other is correct. Any further questions? Yeah.
Is everything unreal, vitata, also papancha?
Is everything that is vitatang also papancha?
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Even the conditional dharma that wholesome, for example, worldly wholesome.
Even worldly wholesome dharmas are
papancha?
In the sense of the diffuseness of the world, I would say that they are papancha.
So does that mean that even worldly wholesome dharma are either too far or not enough?
I would say even the wholesome worldly dharmas eventually have to be transcended. They're part of the diffuseness of the world. But the wholesome worldly dhammas have to be used as stepping stones towards the transcendence. But the wholesome dhammas are not papancha in the sense of conceptual, in the sense that papancha has of conceptual elaboration. In the sense of conceptual elaboration, the factors of papancha are tanha, mana, ditti. That is craving, conceit, and views. Those are the factors that are responsible for creating the conceptual elaborations. But here, this is just my opinion, that in this verse, papancha has a different meaning from that of papancha as conceptual elaboration. You know, I might be wrong, but I just take it here. I just agree with the translation that it has a sense of that multiplicity or diverseness of the world. And that's something to be crossed over, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. And in fact, there is the famous saying of the Buddha. It comes in the famous simile of the raft. That line is also used in the Diamond Sutra. Even dhammas are to be left behind, not to speak of what is non-dhamma. So that would mean even the wholesome, mundane wholesome dhammas are to be left behind.
Then is the Nipatpanja real?
I would say definitely, yeah.
With a real substantial existence?
No, it doesn't have a substantial existence.
Then it's real in what sense?
It's unconditioned. Let's say the unconditioned is real.
It doesn't multiply. It doesn't proliferate.
It's not proliferated.
So it's real, so it has something. But it's not substantial.
It's not substantial in the sense of a self. It's that nature is also void or empty of any kind of selfhood.
But does it exist? Does it have any existence?
Existence is a very slippery notion. Let us say also, conditioned things are also real in the sense that they exist. They have a conditioned existence. They exist as conditioned things, even though they don't exist in the way in which they are conceived. In that sense, they are unreal. Of course, the unconditioned can also be misconceived, though it cannot be experienced. To put this, when it is experienced, all misconceptions about it will fall away. And so it can never be misconceived by one who has experienced it.
I guess I'll have to experience it.
But there is a statement that comes in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 140. I think it goes something like, whatever is of a perishable nature, whatever is of a deceptive nature is false, but Nibbana, which is of an undeceptive nature, is true. This is the supreme noble truth. That is the truth of the cessation of all dukkha, of all suffering. I'm quoting from memory, so it might be a little bit wrong. But it goes something like that. This is the supreme noble truth, Nibbana, which is of an undeceptive nature. Whatever is deceptive, whatever is of a deceptive nature is false. This is the supreme noble truth, Nibbana, which is of an undeceptive nature. Okay.
Upancha, is that something like interpretation or translation? Upancha is more close by the wisdom speaking with that interpretation. I mean, what's the difference between, is there any similarity or difference between upancha and interpretation?
Of course, interpretation has various meanings. I would say papancha, in one of its senses, I render it or interpret it as conceptual elaboration. And so the process of conceptual elaboration involves, it's a step in the process by which we interpret the world to ourselves. And so we use a screen of concepts to make our experience intelligible to ourselves, in other words, to interpret things to ourselves. And so these concepts, which are elaborations, that is, they are concepts arising from within the mind, they're of subjective origin, and we project them out upon the world, and then we interpret our experience through the filters of these concepts, and thereby it's the concepts which form, we call it the net of papancha, become the means of interpretation. And what is central to these concepts that constitute papancha is that they distort experience, they distort what is actually there, and they filter experience, or they constitute experience in terms of the notions of I and other, or in terms of what is I, mine, and self. And so, according to the Buddha's teaching, all these notions of I, mine, and self, myself and others, all of these are conceptual elaborations or projections upon what actually is present, what actually exists. What actually is there is a process of conditionally arisen phenomena arising, passing away. And through the development of mindful attention to what is occurring in the present, one develops insight into this flux, this process of impermanent, constantly changing phenomena. And the insight into that flux of impermanent, impersonal phenomena pulls down that net of concepts woven by delusion, by ignorance. It pulls down the net of papancha. I would imagine that even for an arahant, there's some interpretation of experience. I don't know about a Buddha. But that interpretation will no longer have any of the elements of papancha, in the sense of conceiving in terms of I, mine, and self. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now. I think maybe next week, maybe I can give the talk just to finish up this sutta before the Dhamma retreat, so we finish this. Otherwise, it's sort of suspended for a long time. Okay, we'll close with sharing the merits. Sharing the merit with the devas, the buddhas, and the other beings. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika punyantam anumoditva jirang rakantu sasanam akasata jabumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva jirang rakantu desanam akasata jabumata devanaga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantumam param etavata chaam hehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chaam hehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chaam hehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.